Hello and welcome to the Writers on Rule podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And my name's Jazza and I've been thoroughly enjoying the state visit by French President Emmanuel Macron this week to the UK. I'd give him access to my single market any day.
Jesus Christ. I think that's the
rank. I thought you'd enjoy that.
That's the most sexually explicit introduction to a podcast that we've ever done. I'm slightly disappointed.
I don't know.
Yeah, go on.
No, but didn't I once say that I was a really generous lover and that I was looking for an EU passport?
But I mean, you sort of made a reference to bum sex then, which is, you know, more explicit than generous lover, I think. Generous lover is quite a general statement.
You're the one who generalised it to quote-unquote bum sex, Jimmy.
Access I'm sorry, to my
I didn't realise we
market.
Were still calling it bum sex. I didn't realise we were still calling it bum sex in our mid to late 20s.
Bum sex is a far more entertaining term than anal sex, I'd say. So, there is that. I'm also slightly disappointed that you didn't do an outrageous French pronunciation of Emmanuel Macron.
Don't worry, I'll ham it up throughout the rest of the podcast, because that's one of the things we're going to be talking about.
It is indeed. Do you want to introduce that topic, since you've already mentioned it?
Yeah, so Emmanuel Macron did a state visit to the United Kingdom this week, met with Theresa May. He's ended up being really good at giving, like, state gifts to the people that he's meeting
courting.
Internationally. So he went to the people he's courting, indeed.
To continue with our metaphor.
Very well. So he had dinner with Donald Trump and his wife halfway up the Eiffel Tower. He gave a horse to the president of China, Xi Jinping. Slightly oddly, though, for his UK visit, he offered to loan the UK the Bio Tapestry, which, for people who don't know, is a tapestry that depicts the invasion of the United Kingdom. It would have been England back then. The invasion of England by French conquistadors.
I think conquistadors is a specific term for Spanish colonialists, if I'm
basically, it's a depiction of the last time that England got invaded by a foreign power. Mm. And he's like, hey, do you want to display this in some of your museums as you leave the European Union? This isn't loaded.
Yeah, I mean, it's not actually that obvious what could be interpreted by that, but there are many available interpretations, at least.
There are many. But basically, he had a long, really great interview with Andrew Marr, the BBC journalist, over the weekend. That was broadcast over the weekend. And we're going to be talking a little bit about French scepticism, about the statehood of an Emmanuel Macron, and the rise of France in the European Union. Fun.
I think you also need to introduce the next topic, because it concerns YouTube, which is your domain again.
Oh, Jimmy, have you done any research this week? So
I did. I read the BBC article, but you're like the YouTube guy, so.
Thank you. You've called me worse things, so I'll run with it. YouTube had quite a tumultuous year in 2017, where they had some questionable videos make it through their content blocks, and advertisers were not happy about this. One of the biggest ones of the last few weeks was Logan Paul, the very famous vlogger person.
I'd literally never heard of him until this scandal.
Oh, what a sweet, sweet existence you must have had. So he filmed his reaction, and very inappropriate reaction, to a dead body in a forest in Japan. It wasn't really great. In response to a lot of these criticisms, YouTube has rolled out a load of changes to who and what gets monetized on YouTube, so we're going to be talking a little bit about that. But also, they've announced that they're going to be doing a load of new original content for the UK market. But YouTube is still insisting that they are not a broadcaster, that they do not have editorial, and that they shouldn't be at the receiving end of rulings from Ofcom. Which is an interesting interpretation of law. So we're going to be talking about that as well later on.
I mean, in their defense, and we'll definitely get into the weeds of this later on, they're not a broadcaster in the sense that the Ofcom rules were written for.
100%. I'm not saying that the law is particularly up to date either, Jimmy, but...
No. So I imagine their position's probably defensible from a kind of pedantic point of view, but whether it's probably not defensible from a wider societal point of view, but we will get into that, I guess.
Do you want to do the final one, seeing if I've had to do the rundown for the last two topics?
You're very resentful whenever I ask you to do topic
introductions. I hate doing work, and, Jimmy. Yeah,
it's unbecoming of you. But for the last topic, we're going to be discussing the recent accusations that the American 90s TV show Friends is full of bigotry in the form of transphobic jokes, homophobic jokes, sexist jokes, probably other kind of phobic jokes.
this... Other phobic jokes. Arachnophobic, agoraphobic.
I mean, probably, you know, there probably is some kind of arachnophobic joke in Friends somewhere. But this has arisen recently because Netflix decided to put the entirety of the 10 Friends series onto its catalogue. So apparently millennials, quote unquote, have been discovering it for the first time, even though both me and Jazza are millennials. And I assume you watched most of it when it was actually airing.
What, because I'm older, you dick? Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I watched it when it was airing as well, so
well,
it wasn't a slight on your age.
It was like a Friday evening. Friday evenings from 6 until 7, you got half an hour of Simpsons, half an hour of Friends.
I definitely watched the last series when it was ending, and I picked up most of the rest on like Channel 4 at the time, so I'm a bit sceptical. Millennials are a terrible label anyway, but...
We are older millennials, to be fair, so I don't think... I think often when... the lamestream media talk about millennials, they're thinking about people who are slightly younger than us, but I will not have that label taken away from me quite so easily. I'm a millennial.
On that note, should we do the usual introductions and begin the
podcast? Shall we? Good, excellent.
So this is the part of the podcast where I have to ask you guys to donate us money. If you enjoy what we do and you want to give us some cash towards the running costs of this thing, which include things like website hosting, podcast hosting, which is a separate thing, and also various other things that we are in the process of planning and trying to launch. We currently have 5 patrons who... donate us money on an episodic basis through our Patreon account, which can be accessed at patreon.com/rightdishonorable. I'd like to shout out to Dominique Flood, Matt, Gemma Cumming, Agatha Hoder, and Ollie McGregor. Most of you should have received your badges at this point. I know it was quite a long time coming in terms of us actually getting those made and sent out to you. Right now, I'm just waiting on receipt of the mugs that I ordered a little while back, so once those are in, I will also be sending those out, and all that will be done, and we'll also, I promise, be setting up the monthly live stream at some point when I can bother Jazza to do it at an appropriate time. I don't know what the time will be, but we'll be in touch about all of that further down the line. Now I will shut up and let you listen to the rest of the podcast. So for me, the most controversial thing that's come out of the Emmanuel Macron interview with Andrew Marr is his quote about the hypothetical French referendum on EU membership. There's a clip online, and because Emmanuel Macron's English is very good, but he's not entirely fluent in the particular bit that's been broadcast, but seemingly all the newspapers have run with the headline that if France held a referendum on EU membership, they would, quote, probably end up leaving.
He doesn't really say that.
He doesn't, does he? No. Yeah.
No. I think he's clearly reacting to, yes, it would probably be difficult and there'd probably be a problem. I don't think he ever says the words, "we'd probably leave."
Hang on. I think I've got a transcript of what he says. So he's asked if the French would vote to leave the EU in the same way as the British did in our referendum, and he says, quote, yes, probably in a similar context, but our context was very different, so I don't want to take any bets. I would definitely have fought to win. So when you read the full quote, it doesn't really sound like he's saying that they probably would vote to leave.
Yeah, I also... Yeah, I think that his English perhaps comes into play here. When I was watching it, I remember thinking, oh, I think he's just accidentally said that France would vote to leave the European Union.
Yeah, well,
I don't think that's what his... That didn't come across as what his intent was at all.
Well, he was immediately, like, a little bit awkward after he said it. He was sort of like, oh, I've kind of blundered a little bit here. And I don't think it's because he intended to say what he's been interpreted as saying. I think it's maybe because his English is obviously not as good as his French, and therefore, you know, I think that's the reason. That, at least, is my interpretation of it. But that obviously hasn't really stopped the, you know, the headlines being kind of simplistic in that sense. But, I mean, do you think that if... do you think if France were given a referendum on EU membership, it would be as close as the British one was?
Yes, I believe so. France, when you see polling from institutions like YouGov that regularly ask different nations whether they feel like a citizen of the European Union, places like Germany and the newer states are always higher up on that list, and places like France and the UK are always a lot lower. Like, Euroscepticism and lack of feeling like you're a European it tends to be relatively high. It's not quite as high as the UK, but it is quite high in France. It would certainly be not a given, and I think actually before the Brexit vote in the UK, as opposed to the Brexit votes happening across the world, the French, I think, in general have been a more Eurosceptic country than we have, in a lot of ways, in terms of the national kind of like conversation, especially in regional government and those kinds of things. But it would certainly not be a given that France would vote to stay in. What do I think is super, super interesting about Macron and about like the Eurosceptic part of his country is how, as the president of France, Macron has not decided to govern also for the Eurosceptics. He is the most Europhile president that France has had since, like, the 90s, I would argue.
Who was it in the 90s?
Jacques Chirac.
Oh, yeah. He ended up as a European commissioner, didn't he?
Yeah,
all right, I saying think that? So. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, yeah. Watch us get this wrong. But he is very, and a huge part of his brand, both internationally and nationally, is like to be the technocratic European glamorous politician. And it's very interesting that he's kind of doubled down on that rather than trying to pander to the Eurosceptic base that ended up voting for Le Pen in the French elections last year.
Do you not think it's a bit troubling that he thinks that it would be close, but he's also not willing to hold a referendum? Because if you're assuming there's a big appetite to leave your country, I mean, that was the reason some Remainers, at least, Nick Clegg historically, but then not latterly, supported the idea of a referendum because they thought that the question was, it was important that the question be asked.
But then people like Nick Clegg wanted the question to be asked when there was a question to be asked. So when there was, for example, a treaty change.
That is true, but there's no reason why you wouldn't apply that retroactively as well. Like, there were many, many treaty changes between the 75 referendum and the 2016 referendum, and none of those were ratified, at least in a popular democratic vote.
If people want to have a vote on, if the French people want to have a vote on whether or not they stay in the European Union or part of the Euro, for example, then they need to vote for a Eurosceptic president and party. And that's not what they
I
have.
That's a bit of a specious argument, because nobody would say that just because Labour and the Tories got 80% of the vote, that therefore means that people are in favour of a hard Brexit, even though those are pretty much the positions that the Tories and Labour actually took up, or at least their leadership did, in the general election.
I think that that's a more nuanced stance than having a referendum. It was impossible for Cameron to not offer a referendum because it was literally in his election manifesto in 2015.
Yeah.
And so he had to give a referendum. And that was, and we know this, it was more for appeasing internal Conservative Party fissures along the European Union lines than about the good of the country or what was good for the country.
So I'm wondering under what circumstances you would then say, I mean, if we apply it to a different context, was the Scottish referendum, was it right that the British and Scottish governments held that referendum given that there was a significant amount of support for it?
Let's be clear. The reason that the Scottish referendum happened was because a party got a majority in the Scottish Parliament that said that it wanted to have a referendum on independence. And the same for Catalonia. And I think that that needs to be the benchmark for this to happen.
But why should it be that just because politicians are, significantly misaligned with the publics that they pretend or assert that they serve, just because there's a significant misalignment there, why is it that you shouldn't have a referendum?
But so the thing is, if you are looking at stuff like polling, that's often going to change over an election, over in the run up to something like a referendum. Mm-hmm. So you end up with it looked like before the Brexit vote that the UK pretty much aligned itself more or less with the opinions of people in Parliament. It was something like 70% of people were going to vote to stay in the European Union. And then that gradually got chipped away as we got closer and closer to the vote.
I'm not sure that's true. There's definitely been points in like the post-war era where the majority of Britons wanted to leave the EU and the referendum wasn't held, or at least a good 40%, which I think is a reasonable amount to actually hold a referendum of that sort.
Yeah, but I think that you need to have a sustained, consistent kind of like opinion and expression from the people in order to do a really big change like that.
Well, I think opinion was consistent across a number of years.
You're letting me talk. I don't think that you can do that through like a public opinion poll, because public opinion polls are flawed. I think it needs to be through the distinct act of voting that people can express that opinion. And I think that the best way of being able to do that, referendums, I think, should be relatively difficult to have. And I think that you need to have that as part of a policy decision in a manifesto for the party that you vote for.
I mean, I disagree, because I think there are significant... the view of... even to this day, the view of MPs is not aligned proportionally with the view of actual voters. I guess we just disagree on that point.
Yeah, sure. So, what do you think are the consequences of... So Merkel in Germany has been somewhat occupied with the fact that she doesn't have a government yet. She's still the largest party. We've covered this in the podcast before. She's still the largest party, but struggling to form a coalition that will give her a majority in the Bundestag. They are currently having talks with the SDP, the Social Democratic Party, who came in second, who are the centre-left party. And if they formed another grand coalition with those two largest parties, then the Alternative for Deutschland would end up being the official opposition, and they're basically the Nazis.
That's a little unfair, shall we say. There are certainly Nazis who are associated with Alternative for Deutschland. So
Merkel is tied up at the moment trying to sort that out, and Macron has really kind of risen to be the most prominent figure in European Union politics. What do you think are the consequences of that, especially the fact that he is such a champion of the European Union and its ideals? So he's really sexy and smart.
Is that what you associate with the European Union?
Yeah. Why do you think I voted to stay?
Fair point, I guess. Well, I think it's... Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that a French politician, as opposed to a German politician, is now the, as you kind of put it, the main figure in European politics, because Germany is still still kind of the most important country in Europe, partly because of its role in finance, and also the size of its economy and the dynamism of its economy, etc.
And the size of its population as well. It's the largest by population, yeah.
So there's quite a few fundamental reasons why Europe marches to a German drum, as it were.
Lovely metaphor.
But, I mean, I think actually going back to your previous point about kind of French attitudes towards the EU, I think France has had a more transactional relationship with the EU when you compare it to Germany. It's far more essential to the idea of German political identity that it is part of Europe and that it has a pacifist constitution and that, you know, it's this model of cooperation and stuff, whereas, I mean, I'm more familiar with the kind of early portion of EU history, but if you look at how Charles de Gaulle kind of treated with the EU during its early days, it was very much a tit for tat, we'll do this so long as you you know, give us the common agricultural policy, which the French did exceptionally well out of in the early era, and actually still to a great degree do very well out of. So in that sense, I'd actually say that Macron is actually not as well aligned with his own country as I perceive Angela Merkel to have been when she was the main figure in European politics.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily about being aligned. The interesting thing about this isn't necessarily how they're aligned to their own countries, but actually more about how they project the ideas and the image of the European Union to the rest of the world. Even before we voted for Brexit, the British Prime Minister was never really going to be the symbol of Europe to the rest of the world. I don't think that we've ever really performed that role. You could argue
Tony Blair aspired to that role.
Tony Blair, yeah. I mean, but I think that that is a lot more since he's left the role of Prime Minister than during his term as Prime Minister.
Well, I think that was a significant reason why he advocated for membership of the Eurozone for Britain, is that he wanted to be... I mean, he's been sort of criticised for having a messiah complex in the past.
And he wanted to be president of Europe.
Yeah, kind of like he saw himself as European. He wanted to... It's very similar to Macron in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, something else that kind of strikes me about Macron is he's actually a very New Labour type figure in terms of his
big time
general approach to
the policies he's putting through surrounding workers' rights and working limits is really shaking up the French economy at the moment, or has the idea of shaking up the French economy.
But it sort of runs counter to his image as this as this radical outsider, when actually he's pretty down the middle as it goes in terms
of... Is he seen as a radical outsider?
Well, obviously he was part of the Socialist Party, and he served some sort of government role, and prior to that he was a banker.
He was an economics minister.
Yeah. And he split with the Socialists so that he could run for president as part of En Marche, obviously.
Which is his own movement, right?
Yeah, and which wasn't really until he was elected a conventional political party in any meaningful sense. I haven't really followed the development of that organisation since, but I think
they have a majority in the French Parliament.
Yeah, so it is more of a conventional party these days, isn't it?
It is, but the vast majority of the people who hold seats for En Marche are people who don't have a history in politics.
Yeah. I'm not really close enough to it to actually discuss it in those terms, but I think it's sort of funny that it was portrayed as, at least by publications like The Economist, as this really radical move, and in many ways it was a very conservative move because it was kind of back to the sort of Bill Clinton, Tony Blair way of doing politics to a significant degree.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a good understanding of the details of what he's actually advocating in terms of European Union reform?
I don't in terms of that. I'm more thinking about what ends up getting projected, because when you compare Merkel and him, they are very, very different figures. He is younger, he is male, he is glamorous. He talks about literature and art and is very stereotypically French in that way. So I think he, whereas Merkel is very much tied to the German response to the recession, she's very much tied to the restrictions of Southern European economies, of steady as she goes, of pragmatism. And there is this idea of kind of like romance and kind of like ideology behind Macron, and I actually welcome him having a stronger role as a kind of like a representative of the European Union, not just for the rest of the world, but for the UK too.
What do you see in terms of ideology, or is it ideology in the sense of being pro-European?
It's the ideology of being shamelessly pro-European, of being like, I love being European. I'm going to sit here with the flag, with the French and the European flags behind me when I talk to Andrew Marr, that kind of thing. And he isn't just tolerant of the European Union and pragmatic about the European Union. He believes in it passionately. And as a big Europhile myself, you know how I feel, Jimmy. I find that refreshing, and that's the kind of stuff that I have always missed from the way that we talk about the EU in the United Kingdom.
To be fair, I think there should be politicians throughout Europe who openly advocate for a more centralised or alternatively a more federalised Europe, but, you know, more European integration of some sort, because that is a genuine problem that we have in British politics, is that very few credible figures actually argue for kind of more Europe. I mean, even someone like Nick Clegg, whose book we reviewed last episode, is actually quite tentative about the way he discusses it for cultural reasons. But I mean, you know, there's definitely like a legitimate school of thought that you could actually advocate for it full-throatedly.
I think that actually Nick Clegg's in his book that we reviewed last week, he suggests a kind of like different orbits of the European Union, and so those in the central orbit would end up being more integrated, and those in the outer orbits would be able to stay at those integration rates and stay where they are. I believe that that's something that's also advocated by Macron.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
We maybe should have done some more research before I start this topic.
don't play us, Jimmy.
Okay. Are we? We've
had a wonderful conversation about a very sexy French man.
Stop objectifying male politicians.
Never.
If we were doing Friends decks, we could have effortlessly pivoted towards that topic. But instead, we're going to do YouTube. okay. So, YouTube, do you want to summarise? I know you've done it in the introduction already, but I need reminding at least what it is we're actually talking about vis-a-vis YouTube.
Sure. So YouTube has come under fire recently, not just because of videos that were posted by large creators like Logan Paul in the suicide video, and also PewDiePie, who keeps on using the N-word. Please stop.
I didn't realise that was a thing. I was only familiar with his Nazi.
Also Nazis. Like, he's just... I like him. I'm just like, please stop being an idiot. You know, look bad.
That's kind of his brand now, though, isn't it?
It is 100% his brand. He's also grown a terrible beard. And as someone who...
Also grew a terrible beard.
It wasn't terrible. Mine was cared for. His just looks a fucking mess. But in response to that, basically now all videos as part of Google Preferred, which is the top 5% of videos on the site that go to premium advertisers and have higher advertising rates and click rates, they are going to be manually reviewed by YouTube themselves. This may have consequences for larger creators in terms of how soon their content can be monetized, but we don't really know enough about that yet. We will see later on. Another problem that YouTube has had is ads from advertisers appearing alongside unsavory videos. There was an investigation from The Times that showed that there were like ISIS videos that had beach holiday adverts running alongside them.
But that, so that was also the origin of the PewDiePie. Was it the anti-Semitism scandal where he paid like some people to hold up a sign?
Yeah,
saying something about Jews, is that it was a Wall Street Journal investigation where they contacted the advertisers and said,
hey, did you know that your ad is running alongside PewDiePie getting some South Asian guys to hold up Death to All Jews?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Out of context, that does sound very bad, but, you know.
Does it sound better in context?
I'll tell you the whole story later. In order to respond to that, there's like some extreme examples of this, and I don't know, I think it's kind of funny. So there was an example of a video calling for the Islamification of Kenya, and then the advert running alongside it was a sandals package holiday deal to go to Kenya. So it was like, oh, 1-2 punch.
There's actually a private eye column dedicated to programmatic advertising where, you know, articles about, say, car crashes are paired with, like, horrendous car crashes are paired with, like, car insurance adverts, which sort of lacks taste, I think you can say.
Slightly, but that's how the YouTube algorithm works. So in order to combat that type of unsavory content, YouTube has increased the criteria that you need to reach in order to be able to monetize any of your content. It used to be a channel had to have 10,000 views over its whole lifetime. Now a channel has to have 1,000 subscribers at least over its lifetime, and it has to have had 4,000 hours of watch time over the last 12 months. Sorry.
How are you feeling about these restrictions? Do you think they're a good idea?
Well, clearly, Jimmy, you haven't seen my video about it.
I was just giving you an opportunity to plug it there, and then I've obviously seen it. I watch all of your content religiously.
I don't believe you. But I think that this is sensible. I think that it was communicated appallingly. YouTube, ironically, as technically a media company, are really bad at comms and managed to frame it so it looked like because Logan Paul filmed a dead body, we're now going to stop monetizing smaller YouTubers, which is not what this policy was about.
It is an upshot of the policy, though, isn't it?
No, the changes to Google preferred adverts was a response to people like Logan Paul. The raising of the bar of entry to monetization was directly a response to adverts appearing alongside smaller videos that were potentially about terrorism or about like mental health or any of those kinds of things that weren't seen as advertiser friendly.
But there's a wider narrative of that YouTube doesn't have control of all of the content, be it adverts or the actual videos themselves, on its website / app or whatever, and thus it has to kind of make its whole platform less favorable to the little guys in terms of monetization.
I don't think that's necessarily what is happening. There did used to be an argument that this is where YouTube made an awful lot of its money, the fact that they, like, occupying the long tail and getting ad revenue off of that.
So the long tail is lots of small content creators with small audiences that add up to a large number of views in aggregate, correct?
Yes, exactly, yeah. And the fact that they seem willing to do this either means that they aren't actually earning a huge amount out of the long tail, or they have made like the cost benefit analysis and have decided they're going to lose a ton of money in order to keep advertisers giving them money. What is interesting, the argument that you just expressed about YouTube not having editorial control, this is true, but in fact actually this is a form of editorial control, and there are forms of editorial control that is going to end up affecting the type of content that gets put up on the site. they have automatic demonetization at the moment that essentially automatically takes away premium advertising from any video that isn't PG-13. It happens on my channel an awful lot because I talk about politics. And it's going to stop people from wanting to make that type of content or contentious content. You see this as a huge kind of like grievance from especially alt-right YouTubers who I don't agree with, but they're like, this taking away of advertising of our content is an attack on our free speech, and I think that this is a form of editorial. And as YouTube continues to insist that it isn't an editorial, even as it announces that it's going to be bringing new original shows to the United Kingdom, irony. I don't know how long this can continue with YouTube claiming to just be dumb pipes rather than a site that clearly has an ethos and an editorial that is trying to get its creators to adhere to.
Well, I think it's obviously true that it does have some editorial policies. I mean, there's kind of this myth that the internet is open until, you know, autocratic governments control it, whereas in fact all Western governments do have some, or most at least I'm aware of, have some sort of control in terms of filtering out illegal pornography and, you know, stuff like that, basically. Mm-hmm. So nobody, unless you're using a VPN, is actually accessing the raw internet, as it were. But we sort of find ourselves on opposite sides, I think, in terms of how we usually approach free speech. The thing is, I see where you're coming from with the thing you said about the alt-right and it's an attack on free speech. I'm not sure even you necessarily think that. It's not really an attack on free speech to say to somebody, look, you can still come on our platform, you can still post videos, you can upload your content, you can promote it, link to it, whatever. You're just not going to be able to find it as easy to make money from it as before. I mean, they can still use the platform, can't they?
Oh, I agree with you. But I think that especially as YouTube starts to produce more and more of its own content, that claim to be just the dumb pipes of the internet it gets less and less. And I think that monetization and the running of ads alongside of a piece of content is, like, it is a form of editorial. Mm. It is going to disincentivize people to make that type of content if their main focus is to be able to earn money from that.
Well, presumably, even if it's not their main focus, if you have a YouTuber who has an audience and they're like, well, I can make video A and it might get views, but it's going to be demonetized, or I can make video B and because it's on a less contentious subject, I can make some money out of it. I think it's going to be more those kind of nudge sort of decisions rather than people who are, you know, passionate or slash obsessed about one particular topic and just want to make videos on that topic irrespective of the money.
Yeah, one would think so and one I think would hope so.
But YouTube, even since the start, has actually had editorial control in as much as it's always curated content to some degree, hasn't it?
Yeah, so this was one of the things where, even back in the day, way back in the day, it used to have a front page that it used to feature creators on.
Yeah.
So in an interview with the BBC, the, what's his name? Robert Kinkle, who is the chief business officer of YouTube, was announcing this new content that they're doing in collaboration with James Corden. But they're still claiming to not be people who are producing content, even though they're announcing that they're producing content, or they're getting people to produce content. One of the big things about this is if they were to end up being a broadcaster rather than just a platform, or to be licensed as a broadcaster rather than a platform, they'd have to answer to regulations within the UK, at least, from Ofcom, which would basically have all shit hitting all fans. What do you think about do you think that it's ever possible that YouTube ends up being seen and licensed as a broadcaster in the UK, and what do you think are the implications and possible things of that What do you think? What do you reckon?
I'm not sure it's credible, really, to argue that under the current rules, YouTube or even someone like Netflix is a broadcaster because, as I said earlier, those rules were written for a totally different technological environment. I do think it's very plausible, however, that the Ofcom rules could be updated to include online content providers, which would include YouTube and Netflix. And I think I'm a little bit sceptical about the usefulness of broadcasting rules in general, but part of the reason for that is because I think the internet has made the whole like idea of online regulation of content a lot more difficult. Although I'm sort of working this out in my own head as we go. The other side of that is that YouTube is frankly the only video portal that matters. Bearing in mind that Netflix hosts its own films and TV shows, and also like major studios films and TV shows. But YouTube, in theory, you could regulate YouTube and you would be regulating most of the video output of the entire web, at least from a Western point of view. I could see it happening, although how that actually pairs down in practice, I think, is quite difficult to say.
I think if that does end up happening, we end up like the internet that we grew up with anyway ceases to exist, and especially video content on the web ends up being little more than essentially a subscription model, essentially being cable television. And in a lot of ways, that's what YouTube has kind of been pivoting towards. I would argue that YouTube is like a broadcaster in the way that it currently acts, because of the fact that it is essentially commissioning shows to be broadcast on its platform, in the same way that somebody like the BBC or HBO or Netflix, the same way that they do. If a site like YouTube that was built on user-generated content rather than commissioned content now ends up being told, oh, hold on, you're going to have to adhere to all of these same rules that HBO and Netflix and whatever have to adhere to, then the user-generated section of that experience is going to have to go away.
I think
that YouTube is pivoting towards being okay with that, at least a significant portion of it anyway. I think that we're going to end up seeing a separation of YouTube from, for example, YouTube Red, separating, which is like the broadcast commissioner wing of the business, from the user-generated content one. And I think the user-generated content one is just kind of going to be left to live there.
I think the way that regulation would probably pan out is there'd be pretty significant exemptions for like content creators who don't have a very large audience. There's definitely ways you could do it which would effectively preserve the most of the freedom of like the original user-generated content creators, and then you have different rules for the big guys, which is pretty common in most sectors as far as regulation goes anyway.
There's one other thing I want to say about regulation and the kind of potential need for it for YouTube. YouTube has child-specific platforms that are meant to filter out anything that isn't child-friendly. And it is shocking how hands-off they seem to be on these platforms. They tend to be web apps or like smartphone apps where children are able to just scroll through, and you end up seeing some really disturbing content on there that is made to look like children's content and children's television. I've heard people from, for example, the BBC be very frustrated with the lack of scrutiny that content that is meant to be child friendly
Is this the phenomenon of people
dressing up like Frozen, Elsa, and Spider-Man?
Are people dressing? Are you aware of this thing of sort of 3D generated videos which appear to be done automatically by a program which combines sort of common children's characters, but also they have sort of automatically generated plots and stuff, and there's this creepy music. And if you watch these videos as an adult, it is creepy as fuck because it's just this weird. There must be like a name for it as a phenomenon, but there was a really good Medium article on it a while back.
Yeah, no, I remember. So that's kind of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Is like if YouTube wants to be in these children's spaces, it needs to have stricter editorial, because the editorial that it's doing at the moment is not working. And if you fuck with angry parents' children's experiences, then you're buggered.
I think the thing is, it's difficult to... I mean, I'm trying to think of an organisation that's done it. Obviously, the ethos of the internet was that anybody can create something and upload it, which is what YouTube was based on originally.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to have editorial controls if that's your fundamental baseline, right?
Like, but it wants to be in a space where editorial control is necessary. It wants to be in a space where it wants to have premium advertising from brands who have a reputation to uphold. It wants to... those people to buy ads from them, and those advertisers want to have a certain standard of content. YouTube wants to be in the space for children's content and has built algorithms and self-learning algorithms that don't work and don't filter out content that is inappropriate for children, but they want to occupy that space. If they want to occupy those spaces that have those high levels of quality control needed both for advertisers and for children, then YouTube needs to be regulated in the same way as a broadcaster. But that's
maybe not the same way as a broadcaster, but certainly to equally stringent standards.
But certainly some way, shape, or form, because otherwise you end up with the mess that we have at the moment, and you have a splicing together of a weird kind of like commissioned Netflix experience with people like me chucking up videos every now and again. And I worry that the chucking up of videos section of YouTube is just gonna dissolve, because it's not going to be seen as financially viable.
I don't think it'll dissolve necessarily. I mean, I'm not really aware of how YouTube's finances work in terms of how much money they make off different bits, but it's already certainly true that the YouTube creator community has been sidelined in favour of kind of corporates, basically.
Yeah, like TV, late night, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So it's already kind of happened. I mean, from my point of view, so long as there is still space on the internet for people to upload, you know, their own stuff and actually create their own stuff, it's kind of sad that big companies have like muscled in, but I think it was kind of inevitable to a significant degree. Maybe that's a bit fatalistic, but
yeah, it was. It's a shame, because there isn't a competitor. There isn't a competitor for user generated content in terms of video. And it is slightly strange for me, because YouTube has the monopoly on that it is choosing to pivot towards subscription models and like broadcast, essentially. It obviously it's because those endeavors are more profitable for them, because otherwise why would they be doing it?
I mean, it's probably a combination of profits and wanting to behave well enough that they're not officially regulated, which is generally, for some reason, self-regulation is always seen as more positive than official regulation, I guess, because it probably gives you more flexibility. So I'd say it's partly commercial and partly legal, probably. Mm-hmm. Should we?
Friends.
Yeah, we're done with YouTube.
Care for you.
So, shall I introduce this one?
Yes, please do.
So, as I was saying earlier, Netflix has just released all of the Friends episodes online, and you can go binge watch them to your heart's content, assuming you have a Netflix subscription.
Or you have your ex's Netflix logins.
Also that, yes, or your brothers or sisters or, you know, wives or husbands or whatever. Apparently younger millennials, because Jazza assures me that we are older millennials at the top end of the range.
We are!
have discovered this, and they're super offended by everything, because it's from the 90s and social mores were different back then. Is that a fair summary?
I think that's a fair enough summary. So do you want to give some examples of some of the things that are being found problematic?
So I have an independent article here, Friends, 10 times the classic sitcom was problematic. I should say in advance, I think most of the claims that these are offensive are wrong, but we'll probably disagree. But they're wrong for the same reason.
Jimmy Nichols there speaking for humanity.
So I mean, this example I actually remembered quite well. When Ross voices his disapproval of Ben playing with a doll, Ben being Ross's son. So Ross goes round to his lesbian ex-wife's house and sees that his son's playing with a Barbie doll, and he says, "Why is my boy playing with a Barbie?" And then he convinces himself that his lesbian ex-wife and her partner force Ben to play with Barbies. And this is obviously like a clear example of sort of like gender normalizing behavior or gender stereotyping, and mild, or maybe not so mild, homophobia. Are you offended by that?
Yeah, I don't think it's helpful.
But the thing that...
Because, so can I tell you, like... Friends was pivotal and an important piece of media from the 90s. It's problematic because the 90s were... It's problematic because the 90s were problematic. I think that a lot of the jokes like that one that you just described are problematic because the joke isn't the ignorance of... Like, Ross isn't the joke there.
No, I totally disagree. I think you have it exactly wrong. Ross is the joke there.
I don't think so.
Well, this is the thing. I can read out like one or two more examples, but I think this is probably the essential disagreement we'll have about all this, is that I think in all the examples that have been listed, at least in this Independent article, there might be others elsewhere that are more legitimate, they're all confusing what the subject of the joke is. And generally speaking, they're saying, oh, this character in this show shouldn't have done that. Their behaviour is homophobic or sexist or whatever. And it's like, yeah, their behaviour is bad, but it was acknowledged in the show that it was bad, and it was taking the piss out of them for having done that. Shall I read some more examples to see if...
Yes, please do.
So this is when Rachel hires Tag because he's attractive. And this is described in as a plot that would be textbook sexual harassment. So Rachel hires hot and simple 24-year-old Tag for an assistant job he wasn't qualified for purely because she wanted to date him. And then in the end, Rachel and Tag end up dating until she breaks it off because he's too immature. But from my recollection of the show, it's her behaviour is not seen as good. It's seen as stupid.
Right.
I mean, yeah. Do you have a different recollection of that?
No, I don't have a different recollection of that. I have fewer problems. I don't know. So the thing is, I don't have explicitly a problem with a lot of these storylines being in the show.
Right.
I think that a lot of them aren't funny, but I don't have a problem with them being in the show.
I don't think anyone pretends that Friends was really funny, though, as a show. It's not like a laugh-out-loud kind of sitcom, is it?
I don't know. It won lots of awards.
It's mostly mildly amusing at best.
Yeah, yeah. The laugh track makes you think it's funnier than it actually is. Have you ever seen the supercuts of Friends episodes with the laugh tracks taken out?
I have seen bits of that, yeah.
Oh, it's hilarious. Anyway, much funnier than the actual Friends. But I think the thing that is jarring, especially for younger millennials, is the fact that you would never see a storyline like that in a modern day sitcom. I just don't think that you would. And so it's somewhat uncomfortable and jarring to see that. And I don't think that it's a particularly negative thing, or a positive thing that they're in there. But I don't know. I feel like the fact that we can make jokes about more nuanced things is probably better for society. Don't you think?
I'm not sure I followed your train of thought there.
Oh.
I mean, you're saying that you think you don't think it's a bad or a good thing that there aren't shows with the plots like the Rachel hiring a guy just because she thought he was hot.
No, I think that it is better now because we have more nuanced jokes and jokes that are not about like taking the mickey out of sexual harassment, because that's what it basically is doing. Is it not, right?
I think the sexual harassment there is probably seen as pretty benign because it's a woman doing it to a man.
But yeah, exactly. But I feel like you wouldn't have that these days.
Probably not, but I think...
In a mainstream sitcom, I don't think you would have that. And I don't think that it is particularly a bad thing that we... Because I think that those episodes were somewhat harmless, especially in the tone and the way that they're put across.
Right.
But it is understandably jarring for younger viewers who have never seen anything like that before. Maybe jarring is too much of a dramatic word.
No, I think what you say is true, that there are younger people who have different attitudes to sex and gender and race and all that sort of stuff. You probably do find these plot lines kind of jarring. I think you've kind of got to it, but I'd return to the original point, which I think the butt of the joke in these instances is usually the person who's behaving in a bigoted or inappropriate way.
So I don't get that. What I get from it is that the situation, it's not like look how bad they are, it's more laugh at the situation.
Sometimes so it's laugh at the situation.
There's one example. There's one example that I remember seeing a very long time ago and thinking that it was problematic at like the age of 12, even though I didn't know what the word problematic meant.
You were so woke in your younger years.
Where Rachel tries to introduce herself to Chandler's father, who is a trans woman, and she tries to. She introduces herself to the wrong person, and the lady goes, "Oh, hi, I'm Amanda." And Rachel, thinking that Amanda is Chandler's trans father, goes, "Oh, I get it. A man, duh." And it's less that Rachel is the problem there, and I think it's more that you're laughing at the situation. Isn't it funny that this trans person is called Amanda? Because, lol.
I don't know, I think that's kind of an ambiguous joke. I wouldn't have seen it in the way that you saw it. I always thought it was kind of taking the piss out of, was it Monica or Rachel who actually said that?
I think it's Rachel.
Yeah, well, whichever one it was, I think they're kind of the one that's seen as stupid in that instance. Yeah.
But the thing is, Jimmy, what we're discovering here is that humour differs from person to person.
That's true. Yeah, that is true. That only one group of people I've noticed is sort of shrieking and trying to shut down other people's types of humour.
Are they shrieking, though? Or are they just finding it problematic and saying that they're finding it problematic? I don't think anybody's saying that... I don't think anyone's saying that Friends should be taken off of Netflix and banned from society. I think people are just saying, oh God, isn't this awkward to watch now?
No, I mean, people
are... And of course you're going to be able to find people who are saying, take it off of Netflix, blah, 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 blah. I don't think that's the majority of people. I think people are just going back and looking at it and being like, oh God, this is a bit awkward, isn't it?
But I think accusing this of being a homophobic show misses the point. I mean, I think it's an error to see it in that way.
Are people saying that it's a homophobic... I don't think they are saying it's a homophobic show.
So at least the Independent article I'm reading, does it accuse it of being homophobic?
Well, good old Independent setting the tone.
People have, is all I'm saying. I mean, you know, I'm not saying it's a majority view, but...
No, but you can have jokes in a show that make it homophobic. And I do agree that Friends was never particularly good at talking about... gay people or minorities or trans people.
But it must have been one of the first American shows that had a prominent lesbian couple, at least in the first couple of series.
A prominent lesbian couple? They were in every, 10 episodes for about 30 seconds, and Ross always had the piss taken out of him that he had a hot wife who was a lesbian who left him.
That is true. I mean, it's... I mean, but often in the scenes where Ross is part of the joke with Ross and his lesbian wife is that he's so uncomfortable with lesbianism. And there's a scene where he goes round to their flat and says, oh, you sure have a lot of books on being a lesbian. And his ex-wife's partner replies, oh yeah, you have to do a course before they let you do it. That's a lot of the humour is that sort of thing. It's taking the piss out of Ross. But I mean, I would say just.
So it depends on person to person, big time, because I think a lot of people view that as Ross and as being kind of like the people who are like, oh, aren't lesbians weird kind of thing.
I just don't.
Do you know what I mean?
I don't see that's a legitimate interpretation of it, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. We just have different. Funnily enough, we're seeing the same thing and interpreting it in different ways. Ooh,
but
humans.
I'm actually saying that your view isn't really... I actually think it fundamentally misinterprets the show. The argument that you've advanced, I don't actually think is valid.
Okay.
But we can, you know, we can disagree on that. That's fine. I mean, at any rate, like, you know, some humour is offensive. That's sort of the point. Like, the point of a lot of humour is to be offensive to somebody somewhere, or, you know, attack something. So it's not that weird that some humour would be offensive. But yeah. So, is there anything else you want to say before we wrap this up?
Jimmy's wrong, and you can tell him so at JDE Nichols on Twitter.
Yes, and if you want to tell Jezza how right he is, just to prop up his ailing self-esteem as an aging 20-something, you can find him at Jezza John on Twitter.
Thank you for confirming that I'm the 20-something. You can also find us on rightdishonourable.com or at rightdishonour. Please tweet us. We really like it. And we engage.
We do engage. Good. That's true. And yeah. Leave us a review on iTunes as well, if people still do that as a thing.
Do they? I don't know. I don't have an iPhone anymore, so I don't really know how iTunes works.
Wow, you're so millennial.
I'm so, like, post-noughties.
On that bombshell.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.